It had mass vaccinations, hoping to get its economy going again. Then, because of this, did investments fall? What about business closures? Things that maybe Israel did not consider in its calculations. Then comes a call from the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. A boycott of firms complicit in Israel's occupation is what the BDS movement called. Did their voices get heard? Did the international community react? Things that we'll be looking at.
It was a brutal war. Israel bombed Gaza. There were civilian casualties. On the Israeli side, 11 were killed. On the Palestinian side, about 300. Disproportionate. But another area was also uneven. Rockets from the Gaza Strip, over 4,000, disrupting Israeli lives who ran for cover. Businesses closed across the occupied territories. Israel had hoped to recover lost business from the pandemic, but those numbers would be scrapped for now.
It's a bit stressful, this situation. We are not used to it here in Tel Aviv.
Had Israel thought through the economic risks?
We are privileged to have with us today for this segment a very special guest. He is none other than the former UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Palestine, Richard Falk. He has written for publications including The Nation, Huffington Post, and Al Jazeera. Richard, thank you so much for joining us here on Economic Divide. This war that Israel has waged on the Gaza Strip involving the shelling and the bombing is costing Israel a lot. First, the military cost. Iron Dome interceptors between $50,000 to $100,000 each. Palestinian factions have fired over 4,000 missiles so far. A lot of money trying to intercept these missiles from that Israel is trying to intercept, along with other military costs. What do you make of that? Do you think this is affecting Israel's economy?
Well, I think it's a minor effect as far as the encounter is concerned. It certainly has an impact on Israel, but Israel, I don't think, will feel the pressure of the economic consequences of this upsurge of violence as much as the political consequences, which are much more serious for them. They have always emphasized in these military operations against Gaza that they're also field testing new weapon systems that they then are able to sell at a premium to other countries.
Okay, thank you so much. We appreciate that, Richard Falk talking there. And, of course, Richard Falk is the former UN Special Rapporteur for the Palestinian territories. We appreciate his comments. When Israel decided to harshly crack down on Palestinians who wanted to pray at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, which led eventually to the Gaza War, did it calculate the economic losses of its offensive? Well, here's a snapshot of how Israel was doing up until the war. Now, as you can see, for the years 2018 and 2019, which is coming up shortly, well, there was modest growth there, 3.5% and 3.4%. But then came the dip, the GDP contraction of over 20% for the year 2020. Economic growth expectations were high for 2021 due to the vaccination of more than 50% of its population. But 6.3%, that was the projection. That did not come into fruition, however. Now, the unemployment figure in Israel was shockingly high relative to the GDP contraction. Prior to the COVID-19, the unemployment rate, which was reported at that time, as we can see over here, was 30%, a little over 30% prior to the pandemic, but it hit over 30% last year counting the ones that were on furlough. After the vaccination program, it decreased down to 16.7% for the month of February. Now let's take a look at the poverty rate in Israel. The economic fallout from COVID-19 had a devastating impact on many sectors across the board. Now the rate stood at 30% at the end of last year, which also is reflective of an inequality problem that Israel is facing. These are things that not many know about. So putting these economic figures next to each other, it's easy to see that Israel's economy was not even doing that great going into the war. Well, here is the most shocking fact about Israel's economy, and it's something that Israel always seems to boast about, that it's doing well, that it has an advanced economy, but it couldn't be further from the truth.
We also discussed Israel's unique and frankly deeply troubling predicament as a democracy grappling with a pandemic in the context of a constitutional crisis that has left the political system virtually paralyzed.
Okay, that's a presenter from I-24, it's an Israeli channel, but let's review what he said, because it's very important, and again, it's something that's under the radar. It's not really covered that much. First of all, at the time the COVID-19 hit Israel, Israel suffered from a recession, so that's number one. Then you had business closures that happened as a result of that. Of course, the pandemic led to business closures, and it also suffered from unemployment. These are all economic factors that has constituted to Israel's economic crisis. Now, Israel has had elections four times for the prime minister position, but without a clear winner for that post. So therefore, it is suffering from a constitutional crisis, one which has not only left the political system paralyzed, but has affected its budget and subsequent spending.
As a result, Israel, incredibly, has had to contend with a pandemic without a state budget. Believe it or not, we're still running on a budget conceived in 2017, and the current government is on the verge of collapse because it has failed to pass a budget for the remainder of 2020, let alone 2021.
We can see how bad Israel is doing. I mean, no budget for 2020 and no budget for the year 2021. Well, how can it operate then? I mean, how can it spend money? How did things get so bad? I mean, how did Israel slide to what many have called both an economic and political bankruptcy?
Above all, Prime Minister Netanyahu, I mean, he takes the responsibility. In the last years, it's not really governments, because Netanyahu does whatever he wants. He really became a one-show man, for the good and for the bad, and all the responsibility is on his shoulder, for the good and for the bad. The good things that happened to Israel, the bad things that happened to Israel, they are right now all Netanyahu, because he doesn't let anyone else really to run any kind of independent policy.
Keyword there, independent. Okay, that was Gideon Levy, author and journalist. Let's get some sense of why Israel then would wage a war at this point in time with an economy that is surely not on stable footing. We're going to bring in Blaine Coleman in a second. He's an activist for the BDS movement into this segment. He's also a commentator at public meetings at the Ann Arbor City Council and at the Central Student Government at the University of Michigan. But before we bring him in, we're going to show you in action at the Ann Arbor Human Rights Commission taking a stance on the U.S. military aid to Israel, which gives us a sense where he comes from when it comes to Israel.
Up to now, no American city council has passed a resolution to cut off military aid to Israel. And asking to cut off military aid to Israel is a very, very modest proposal, considering how they've used that military aid to massacre many, many Palestinians. I don't have to tell you that Israel shot down thousands of human rights demonstrators who were Palestinian in Gaza, who are unarmed human rights demonstrators. Israel shot them down.
Okay, there you saw him in action. Well, let me bring him in and ask him about what he thinks in terms of the war. Blaine, we're looking at the economy of Israel, the fighting with Hamas, weakening Israel's economic growth for Q1, and may dent 2021's Israel's economy for the year 2021 in terms of the growth. Now, at this point, Israel's economy has contracted by 6.5%. 4% for the first quarter. The Central Bureau of Statistics said this could curb its economic recovery from the pandemic. Has Israel figured this into its cost when it waged the war?
Well, you know, I don't read Haaretz and Jerusalem Post and the Zionist press, so I don't know what they're thinking, but I imagine that they have figured all of those economic costs in. I can tell you that apartheid South Africa had all kinds of costs like that while it was, you know, wreaking havoc across Africa in the 1970s and 80s. And I imagine their economy contracted a bit. This is not what doomed apartheid South Africa, the dollars and cents. What doomed them is the political cost of the whole world just hating apartheid South Africa for being a violent, racist state. And that is the only reason they couldn't carry on, not the money part. Israel is now in the same area of its political decline. They can replace the money, they can have their economy contract, uncontract. That's not their problem. Their problem is the world is more growing to hate them, and especially the United States public is more growing to hate them for their racism. Does Israel still have a majority of the U.S. public behind it? Yeah, but a sizable, disgusted minority of the U.S. public really hates the racism and the apartheid of Israel.
Well, we're headed for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere. Our in-depth section is coming up, and we have more guests joining us to break down the huge economic gamble that Israel took when it assaulted Gaza.
First, the military cost. The cost of Iron Dome's interceptors, estimated to be anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000 each. This is while cost of rockets fired by Hamas, somewhere between $300 to $800 each. The difference in cost, huge. But what's more important, Hamas rockets draining tens of millions of dollars from the Israeli economy at little cost to themselves. The Iron Dome is estimated to have intercepted around 4,000 rockets at a cost of $200 million. Israel says its military inflicted a heavy toll, but did it achieve its aim?
אני בא עכשיו מהבור בקריה לחמל המבצעים של צה"ל. זה מרשים ביותר. כל יום שעובר, אנחנו פוגעים בעוד יכולות של ארגוני הטרור. מסכלים עוד מפקדים בכירים, מפילים עוד מגדלי טרור, פוגעים בעוד מצבורי נשק.
Victory is hard to measure. In light of the military costs, there are those who profit from such wars. Above all, the weapon manufacturers provide the Israeli military with weaponry, namely the U.S. The U.S. provides Israel with around $4 billion in military aid. The catch? Israel needs to buy all of its military arsenal from the U.S. Is that why the U.S. was not so quick to lend a hand in stopping this war?
We've said before, Israel has the right to defend itself.
I want to read something a mother named Iman in Gaza wrote 2 days ago. She said, quote, "Tonight, I put the kids to sleep in our bedroom so that when we die together." And no one would live to mourn the loss of another.
There is no equivalence between a terrorist group indiscriminately firing rockets at civilians and a country defending its people.
The statement broke me a little more because of my country's policies and funding will deny this mother's right to see children live, her own children live without fear and to grow old without painful trauma and violence. We must condition aid to Israel on compliance with international human rights and end the apartheid. We must, with no hesitation, demand that our country recognize the unconditional support of Israel has enabled the erasure of Palestinian life and the denial of the rights of millions of refugees.
Now is the time to take a look at some of the other headlines that are making its way into our radar in the info news section. The first item that we're going to take a look at is something we've looked at in the past week, and it concerns the crypto market. There was a crypto crash. Bitcoin, Ethereum to have plunged. This market is not going through good times right now. Nearly $1 trillion in losses. $1 trillion. It's a little bit over $2 trillion market share that it has, the crypto market. Now, the sharp drop came on top of news that China's banning cryptocurrencies, and it's going to crack down hard on where mining is occurring. Also, there's news coming from the Fed that's going to crack down on some of the crypto houses, and that, again, is not good news, which has led to the drop in the crypto prices. Next up, inflation. Inflation is plaguing the economic growth. Now, the rise in inflation has actually hit the U.S. economy in terms of it trying to progress and to come out of the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, because of that, investors are cutting down on their portfolios, so they're not going to invest on some of the more riskier items. They're going to go to safe bets, for example. Government bonds is one option that they may take. Next up, the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear talks. Some saying that nothing's going to come out of it. Others saying that there are positive signs coming from it. For example, India ready to import Iranian oil. That's a positive sign. Also, the oil market itself seems to be responding to that positive news coming from the talks, where there's been a drop of $2 per barrel. If this happens, if the JCPOA happens, and if the sanctions are removed on Iran completely, which is what Iran has requested. Again, a wait-and-see game there. Then on to child poverty. In the UK, in particular in London, where it has the highest child poverty rate of any region in the UK. What is the percentage, you may ask? Let's take a look at what that says. 40% were living in poverty even before the pandemic. So obviously that's a huge problem for London, and that is the capital, so you can imagine what some other regions are going through.
The numbers are out. Israel's defeat at the hands of the resistance came with a cost. The economic cost for Israel over the course of the war is reported to be $37 million per day. Another source puts that figure at almost double, $61 million a day. Neither figure is good for Israel, which is trying to recover from a pandemic-hit economic recession. The war has decreased Israel's economic growth, especially coming out of a quarter that saw 6.5% contraction. Israel's economy was projected to grow between 5 and 7% this year on the heels of a rapid vaccination rollout. Because of the war, consumer and government spending and investment fell in the quarter, while exports rose. After all, how can business sentiment and investment remain high when Hamas rockets have reached areas in occupied Palestine that it had never reached before? Yet the key challenge facing Israel is how much unrest there will be in the occupied West Bank. For example, there was a one-day general strike in occupied Palestine. All businesses were shut. How many more of these shutdowns can Israel endure?
In this segment of the Q&A, we're going to talk about the BDS movement, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction. This movement, which began years ago, has been very successful in its intention and in its goal. In this case, against Israel. There's been a number of products that have been boycotted as a result, products coming from Israel. It was responsible, after all, for the ending of the apartheid regime there in South Africa. But let's find out what our guests think about this. We're going to have the former U.S. Special Rapporteur Richard Falk rejoin us for this. Richard, the BDS movement has urged a military embargo on Israel, a boycott of firms who are complicit in Israel's occupation. It also is calling for the cancellation of academic, cultural and sporting events. Do you think there's enough momentum behind the call by the BDS to basically embargo Israel?
Yes, I think it is. I think it is different. How different is uncertain. But I do think that there will be a greater support, show of support around the world for the BDS campaign, and specifically favoring an arms embargo, and that will have some effect. And it will also, I think, have an effect on these normalization agreements that were reached in the last period of the Trump presidency, and gave Israel a certain political sense that they could ignore Palestinian grievances and still have benevolent relations with their Arab neighbors, and particularly the Gulf countries.
All right, Gilad, do you agree with Richard Falk in terms of what he said on the BDS?
Yeah, I am one of those guys who are actually very troubled by the BDS movement. I don't have any issues with economic boycott, but I think that this movement failed completely on that front. And instead of doing that, it actually worked intensively and extensively against freedom of speech.
The war on Gaza has ended. Well, you see, it has not. Why? Because, forget about the ceasefire. You can't have a ceasefire in a conflict that is over 60 years old. I mean, you can't have a ceasefire in an apartheid regime that has killed Palestinians, especially in the Gaza Strip, a war that appears to erupt every few years. So, what is the solution? Well, Palestinians need to prosper economically, for one thing. The occupied land, for another, needs to not be occupied or have an occupation regime execute its apartheid policies. That just can't happen. By the way, many of those violations are violations of human rights and even war crimes. Now, one solution? To have a referendum. A referendum to be held among the original Palestinians. This way, the governance issue at least can be solved, and most likely the rest is going to fall into place. And also, on the issue of the U.S. as a broker for a peace process, well, that just hasn't worked. The last time around, it was called the deal of the century. Where is that now? Gathering dust, along with one of its architects, Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, who called the Palestinian-Israeli issue, by the way, a real estate transaction issue. Palestinians need their homeland, period. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Your questions and comments are always welcome. Do send them to us. From Mikhail Tatlay and the entire team, it's goodbye until the next program.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
the limelight. The Republican-controlled Texas legislature was racing against the clock on Sunday night, 30th of May, to pass a sweeping overhaul of the state's election laws that would rubber-stamp some of the most rigid voting restrictions in the country. But Democrats were pledging an all-out fight to try to stall the bill and prevent it from passing by a midnight deadline. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Nick Corasaniti, Austin Ramsey, and Anna Shaverian. The piece is titled, Texas GOP Races to Pass Voting Bill as State Democrats Push Back. Stay with us for more. Republican-controlled Texas legislature was racing against the clock on Sunday night, 30th of May, to pass a sweeping overhaul of the state's election laws that would rubber-stamp some of the most rigid voting restrictions in the country. But Democrats were pledging an all-out fight to try to stall the bill and prevent it from passing by a midnight deadline. Though Republicans control both chambers of the legislature, Democrats were becoming increasingly bullish of their chances of delaying passage of the bill and preventing it from coming to a floor vote in the House through either legislative maneuvers or a lengthy debate. Earlier on Sunday, after a legislative power play by Republicans that led to an all-night session and hours of impassioned debate and objections from Democrats, the Senate passed the bill. Republicans in the House professed confidence that the bill would still pass on Sunday. Failure to meet the deadline would represent a setback for GOP lawmakers determined to usher in a raft of new limits to voting and would force Texas Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican, to call a special session of the legislature to pass the bill. Governor Greg Abbott, who could call a special session as early as June, had previously stated that an election overhaul was one of his top priorities for this legislative session, and he was widely expected to sign whatever bill Republicans passed. The bill includes new restrictions on absentee voting, grants broad new autonomy and authority to partisan poll watchers, escalates punishment for mistakes or offenses by election officials, and bans both drive-through voting and 24-hour voting, which were used for the first time during the 2020 election in Harris County, Texas, home to Houston and a growing number of state Democratic voters. The bill in Texas, a major state with a booming population, represents the apex of the national Republican push to install tall new barriers to voting after former President Donald J. Trump's loss last year to Joseph R. Biden Jr., with expansive restrictions already becoming law in Iowa, Georgia, and Florida in 2021. Fueled by Donald Trump's false claims of widespread fraud in the election, Republicans have passed the bills almost entirely along partisan lines, brushing off the protestations of Democrats, civil rights groups, voting rights groups, major corporations, and faith leaders. President Joe Biden and key Democrats in Congress are confronting rising calls from their party to do whatever is needed, including abolishing of the Senate filibuster, which moderate senators have resisted, to push through a major voting rights and elections overhaul that would counteract the wave of Republican laws. After the Texas bill became public on Saturday, Joe Biden denounced it, along with similar measures in Georgia and Florida, as an assault on democracy, blasting the moves in a statement as disproportionately targeting black and brown Americans. He urged Congress to pass Democrats' voting bills, the most ambitious of which, the For the People Act, would expand access to the ballot, reduce the role of money in politics, strengthen enforcement of existing election laws, and limit gerrymandering. Another measure, the narrow John Lewis Voting Rights Act, would restore crucial parts of the 1965 Voting Rights Act that were struck down by the Supreme Court in 2013, including the requirement that some states receive federal approval before changing their election laws. The bill in Texas, if it passes, is unlikely to be the final GOP voting legislation this year. Multiple states, including Arizona, Ohio, and Michigan, have legislatures that are still in session and that may move forward on new voting laws. Republicans in Michigan have pledged to work around a likely veto from Governor Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat, by collecting signatures from citizens and seeking to pass new restrictions through a ballot initiative. Republican lawmakers in battleground states have been backed in their effort by a party base and conservative media that have largely embraced the election falsehoods spread by Donald Trump and his allies. GOP legislators have argued that the nation must improve its election security, even though the results of the last election have been confirmed by multiple audits, lawsuits, and court decisions. Election officials and even Donald Trump's own attorney general as free, safe, fair, and secure. In a provision added late in the process, the Texas bill would make it easier to overturn the results of an election in the state in some circumstances. Texas law previously required proof that illicit votes had resulted in a wrongful victory. The new measure says that the number of fraudulent votes would simply need to be equal to the winning vote differential. It would not matter for whom those votes had been cast. By seeking to ban drive-through voting, 24-hour voting, and the use of tents or temporary structures as polling locations, the legislature is targeting cities and suburban areas where Democrats did well in November. Roughly 140,000 residents of Harris County used one of those methods in the 2020 presidential election. The bill would also bar election officials from mailing out absentee ballot applications to voters who have not specifically requested them, and says that any voter with an illness, injury, or disability that does not prevent the voter from appearing at the polling place on election day may not cast a ballot by mail. The bill also creates new regulations for the maintenance of voter rolls, which could lead to bigger and more frequent purges of voters from the lists. And it would give partisan poll watchers extensive access to voting sites, stating that they must be able to sit or stand close enough to see and hear the election officers. As with bills passed in other states, voting rights groups say the new provisions in Texas will be likely to disproportionately affect poorer people and people of color. They're intent on creating voting restrictions that reverse the trends that they've seen in Texas. Gilberto Hinojosa, the chair of the Texas Democratic Party, said in an interview this month. And they're all geared around minorities in the sense that they're primarily affecting large urban areas that are where most of the people of color in this state live today. What they're trying to do is create a system that discourages people from actually going out to vote, he said. Republicans in the legislature have defended the bill, falsely arguing that it contains no restrictions on voting and saying that it is part of a years-long effort to strengthen election security in the state. Even so, they have acknowledged that there was no widespread voting fraud last year in Texas, and the Republican Secretary of State testified that the state's election was smooth and secure. This isn't about who won or who lost. It's really to make the process better. State Senator Brian Hughes, one of the Republican sponsors of the bill, said in an interview this month. state senator Brian Hughes added, "We want to make the elections more accessible and more secure, make them smoother." Hughes pointed to a case in which a Democratic county commissioner in his district was indicted in October on charges of fraudulently soliciting mail votes. "When the problems occur in the elections in Texas, we try to address them," Brian Hughes said. "How much fraud is okay? Is it never acceptable to have fraudulent elections?" Voting rights groups have long pointed to Texas as one of the hardest states in the United States for voters to cast their ballots. One recent study by Northern Illinois University ranked Texas last in an index measuring the difficulty of voting. The report cited a host of factors, including a drastic reduction of polling stations in some parts of the state and stricter voting identification laws. As the spring legislative session neared its conclusion on Monday, the process took several unexpected turns that sent the deliberations deep into the early morning hours on Friday, when the final provisions were hammered out, and then again late on Saturday, when Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and other Republicans suspended rules that require a bill to be public for 24 hours before a final vote. That set off hours of debate before the Senate passed the bill around 6 a.m. on Sunday morning by an 18-13 vote.
الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz.
The characteristics of an ideal president. Presidential candidates should be really sure about the capabilities of the country. They should also believe in the youth. They should recognize the youth as the engine of the country's general movement, and they should trust them. I have been in contact with youth since long ago, and I have been trusting them for years over different issues. In whichever area the youth enter, it is not necessary to mention which areas. They really untie difficult knots and solve the problems. So the president should believe in the youth. He should also believe in the people and be an optimistic person. He should not be a hopeless and pessimistic person with a bitter and dark outlook towards the future. If there is such a person with the power to manage problems, he will surely help the country reach the ideal point. You should find a president with such characteristics.
Subhanallah,
of course, it is not easy for all people to find such a person. Well, they can refer to others and ask for their opinion. In any case, they should try to find a candidate with such characteristics. We should ask God to help the Iranian nation find and elect a person with such characteristics. The last point about elections is that our dear nation should look at elections as a symbol of national unity, not as a symbol of division, discord, and polarity. They should abandon wrong divisions such as left and right and the like. What is important is the future of the country and of our future generation. What is important is the dignified Islamic system in the country. These are the important issues. They should consider these things and stand together in the true sense of the word. Of course, there are differences in opinion, in taste, and in political tendencies, and there are differences of opinion between ethnicities and denominations. These are completely all right. They used to exist before as well. They exist now and will exist in the future too. It is all right, but these things should not undermine national unity, set the people against one another, and create polls in the country. Well, these statements were related to the elections.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
in the limelight.
U.S. Republicans killed the effort to set up a 9/11 style inquiry into the attack on the Capitol by a pro-Trump mob despite broad popular support for such an investigation and pleas from the family of a Capitol police officer who collapsed and died after the siege and other police officers who battled the rioters. We now present you an article written by Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled How Mitch McConnell Killed the U.S. Capitol Attack Commission. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Before the U.S. Senate voted down the creation of a 9/11 style commission to investigate the Capitol attack, the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell was adamant. He would oppose the bill regardless of any amendments, and he expected his colleagues to follow suit. He said the commission that would have likely found former U.S. President Donald Trump and some Republicans responsible for the insurrection posed an existential threat to the GOP ahead of the midterm elections and would complicate efforts to regain the majority in Congress. Mitch McConnell's sharp warning at a closed-door meeting had the desired effect on Friday, 28th of May, when Senate Republicans largely opted to stick with the Senate minority leader. All but six of them voted to block the commission and prevent a full accounting into the events of 6th of January. But it also underscored the alarm that gripped Mitch McConnell and Senate Republican leadership in the fraught political moments leading up to the vote, and how they exploited fears within the GOP of crossing a mercurial former president to galvanize opposition to the commission. The story of how Republicans undermined an inquiry into one of the darkest days for American democracy, five people died as a pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol building and sought to hang former Vice President Mike Pence, it is informed by eight House and Senate aides who spoke on condition of anonymity. Surrounded by shards of broken glass in the Capitol on the night of 6th of January, and as House Democrats drew up draft articles of impeachment against Donald Trump, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, made her first outreach to canvass the prospect of a commission to investigate the attack. In the immediate aftermath of the insurrection, Nancy Pelosi had reason to be hopeful. Spurred on by the threat felt by many Republicans to their personal safety, a swelling group of lawmakers had started to agitate for an inquiry to reveal how Donald Trump did nothing to stop the rioting. But what was once heralded as a necessary step to investigate and report on the attack and interference in the election proceedings unraveled soon after, with the commission swiftly reduced to an acrimonious point of partisan contention in a deeply divided Capitol. The main objection from House and Senate Republicans at first centered on the lopsided structure of Nancy Pelosi's initial proposal. That would have seen a majority of members appointed by Democrats, who would have also held unilateral subpoena power. And only weeks after the riot, the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy was already advancing the complaint for his ultimate opposition that the scope of the commission did not include unrelated far-left violence from last summer, a political priority that stalled talks. With little progress 3 months after the Capitol attack, Nancy Pelosi made a renewed effort to establish a commission on 16th of April, floating a revised proposal that mirrored the original 9/11 commission, with the panel evenly split between Democrats and Republicans. Nancy Pelosi briefed her leadership team that included the House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, the House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn, the Assistant Speaker Catherine Clark, and notably the Chair of the House Homeland Security Committee Benny Thompson about the proposal the following days. We'll be right back. During that meeting, Steny Hoyer first raised the prospect of also extending equal subpoena power to Republicans, a concession that would allow Democrats to meet all of Republicans' demands about the structure of the commission, which Nancy Pelosi adopted just a few days later. By the penultimate week of April, Nancy Pelosi had deputized Benny Thompson to lead talks as she felt the Homeland Security Committee was an appropriate venue, and because the top Republican on the committee, John Katko, was one of only three House GOP members to impeach Donald Trump. With the House on recess, Benny Thompson made enough progress in negotiations to brief Nancy Pelosi and her leadership team on 8th of May that he secured a tentative deal on the commission, though John Katko wanted to wait on an announcement until Liz Cheney was ousted as GOP conference chair. Tensions within the House Republican conference had reached new highs the previous week, after Liz Cheney continued her months-long criticism of Donald Trump's lies about the stolen election and a party retreat in Florida, and John Katko was wary of injecting the commission into the charged moment. Benny Thompson said in remarks first reported by CNN, as soon as the vote on Liz Cheney is taken, he will be prepared to do a joint statement. Minutes after House Republicans elevated Elise Stefanik to become the new GOP conference chair on 14th of May, Benny Thompson and John Katko unveiled their proposal for a bipartisan 9/11-style commission. The ouster of Liz Cheney solidified Donald Trump's outsized influence on the Republican Party and set the scene for the weeks to come. Kevin McCarthy almost immediately sought to distance himself from the commission and was non-committal about offering his endorsement. Asked whether he had signed off on the deal, Kevin McCarthy was direct. He said, "No, no, no," he told reporters in the basement of the Capitol building. By the following Tuesday, top House Republicans were urging their colleagues to oppose the commission bill, with Kevin McCarthy positioned against an inquiry on the basis that its scope focused narrowly on the Capitol attack. As Steny Hoyer had anticipated when he suggested that Nancy Pelosi also offer equal subpoena power to Republicans, Kevin McCarthy struggled to demonized the commission, and several House Republicans told The Guardian that they found his complaints about the scope unconvincing. Meanwhile, the Senate minority leader had, until then, denounced Donald Trump, who he faulted for inciting the insurrection, and publicly seemed open to a commission. But as it became clear the scores of House Republicans would vote for the bill, his calculus quickly changed. Days after the Senate returned for votes on 17th of May, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell informed Senate Republicans at a private breakfast event that he was opposed to the commission as envisioned by the House, and made clear that he would embark on a concerted campaign to sink the bill. Underpinning Mitch McConnell's alarm was the fact that Democrats needed 10 Senate Republicans to vote in favor of the commission, and 7 had already voted to impeach Donald Trump during his second Senate trial, a far more controversial vote than supporting an inquiry into the 6th of January riot. Cognizant that Senate Democrats may find 3 or 4 more allies in uncertain Republicans, Mitch McConnell cracked down. After announcing at the breakfast event that he would oppose the commission, Mitch McConnell railed against the bill as being slanted and unbalanced on the Senate floor, in biting remarks that represented a clear warning as to his expectations. He kept up the pressure all afternoon on that Wednesday, so that by the evening, Mitch McConnell had a major victory when Senator Richard Burr, who voted to impeach Donald Trump only 4 months earlier, abruptly reversed course to say that he would reject the commission. In the end, only 6 Senate Republicans, that is, Mitt Romney of Utah, Susan Collins of Maine, Bill Cassidy, Rob Portman, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Ben Sass of Nebraska voted to move forward on the commission. As the final vote hurtled towards its expected finale, the Senate Minority Whip, John Thune, who also switched his position to side with Mitch McConnell, acknowledged McConnell's arguments about a commission jeopardizing Republican chances to retake majorities in the House and Senate. Summarizing his concerns, John Thune said, "Anything that gets us rehashing the 2020 elections, I think, is a day lost on being able to draw a contrast between us and the Democrats' very radical left-wing agenda."
Around the World with Reporters.
According to British daily The Sun, the US is going to follow a complex strategy regarding the withdrawal of its troops from Afghanistan. The Sun reported that Washington is going to keep hundreds of its forces in the country in order to avoid the collapse of Kabul by Taliban. According to the report, 600 U.S. Marines could be deployed to protect the U.S. embassy in Afghan capital. British and Turkish troops may reportedly assist the U.S. forces. However, experts here believe such a move is part of Washington's psychological war against Afghans after spreading further fear among locals.
The U.S. is after wickedness. It threatens us of the consequences of its withdrawal, such as the fate of women's rights. But we ask them to just leave our country. We know how to deal with the challenges.
In the meantime, many have named the U.S. government as a symbol of imperialism that doesn't care about basic issues such as peace, human rights, and liberties.
It's very naive to think that Americans came here to do anything with poverty, to do anything with peace building, to do anything with democracy or human rights. It's, in fact, it's the other way around. The American presence, not in Afghanistan, but in the region and in the world, in the bigger picture, is to create more conflict, is to create more poverty, is to create more dependency to the United States.
As observers say, the U.S. and its allies want to draw a dark picture for the future of Afghanistan. Under such a scenario, the Afghan government will soon collapse by the Taliban and the country will go back to 1990s. In such circumstances, political elites in Afghanistan say, since Afghans have fully experienced the cost of foreign interference in their country over the past four decades, they need to firstly come together and make a united nation and then make a strong policy to deal with